All right, welcome to our class on Christian theology. And it's going to be taught by Robert and myself. Robert's going to be doing the first 20 minutes, so I'm just kind of getting us started. Then I'll be taking it from there. And next week I won't be here. Robert's going to do the whole class, so he'll explain what he's doing there. And are you going to mention the books then? All right, great. So I really appreciate you coming. Generally, we come to classes that have a bit more definite, you know, like we're going to study the book of Colossians. But what was the illustration, Chris Chang? What was the illustration you heard just this week about theology? He said it's like a guy trying to get some work done and his desk was a mess. He said, but once he got his desk all arranged, all neat and ordered, then he was able to get more work done.
Yeah.
And so studying systematic theology, where if you kind of understand God from the broader perspective, it helps you put everything in a better place, make less mistakes, hopefully be closer to God. So I really think that the time you're going to spend the next 7 or so weeks are going to be time very well spent. So I'm going to hand it off to Robert and say, welcome to our class.
Okay.
Good morning, guys. How's everybody's morning?
Yeah. Hey, can I just, I'd love to know who's here. So, can we go around and just introduce yourself and how long you've been a Christian? So, start here.
Pedro Figueroa, I'm in the Tamarata region. I've been a Christian 26 years.
26 years. Wow, dude, you've been around a long time.
Chris Chang, Tamarata.
Norma Mathis, South Bay, 15.
Annie Rumble, mission, 11 years.
11 years.
I'm Steve Hill, I'm in the mission, I'm 15.
Shannon Steiner,
15.
David Kim, 11 years.
Jeff Glancic, 19 years.
Eric Gonzalez, 9.
John Oaks, 30.
Lisa, I'm Molly, from mission, and I've been Christian 18 years.
Angel Rama, mission, 5 years.
Tim Losaki, mission, 15 years.
Bryce Guthrie,
10. 10 years. Wow. Robert Creel, 26 years. Okay. Wow, that's pretty cool. I'm not the oldest Christian around. Usually there's, you know, everybody's like, wow, dude, you're an ancient, you know. But some of you guys are even older. I'm excited about this class. I think this is a hugely important class and something that I feel like there's absolutely a great need, particularly in our fellowship, really in any fellowship, in any group, in any church, in any organization, but particularly with ours as we're going through a lot of changes and growing, and we've definitely been going through a spiritual growth time. I love this subject. And much to my encouragement and surprise, about a year ago I asked, when I was in the South region, I asked at a service, you know, what do you guys want to study? And somebody said theology. And I said, I don't know if anybody else is going to be interested in theology. I said, is anybody else interested in theology? And about half the hands went up in the room. So I was pleasantly surprised. I'm just going to introduce the course, and then John's going to jump right on in. You have the books here, right? There's a couple of books that we're going to recommend. There's one book that I really want everybody to read. Here's the title of the book, A Little Exercise for Young Theologians, by Helmut Thielke. This is kind of an introduction to higher studies in general. But it's a little exercise for young theologians. It's an excellent book. It kind of helps us to get our first steps pointed in the right direction, especially I know a lot of you guys I've seen before, and a lot of you guys are pursuing other advanced studies, and you've been in the other classes, and I think this book really helps us just with our mindset and which direction we're going. Here is another book. This is just more if you're interested. This one I really want everybody to read. I really want to encourage everybody to read. And by the way, Amazon.com is usually a whole lot cheaper than Borders or Barnes & Noble. And the other one is Christian Book Distributors. I don't know if you have any other places you get your books, John, but those are the two places I get my books. Christian Book Distributors, CBD. and Amazon.com are usually a whole lot cheaper than any other place. And some of these books can get rather expensive. John's got a couple here. I'll let John talk about it more. But A Short History of Christian Doctrine and The Story of Christian Theology. This one I would imagine costs a pretty penny, huh? Most of my books now for classes cost around $100. So these books you can get on Amazon.com for like $20 or $15. So I always say hallelujah very loud when I find them like that. Here's another one. If you really want to be a theology nerd, then this is a great book. It just kind of gives an overview of what's out there, from websites to books to I mean, there's just a ton of resources out there. I mean, actually, to begin the graduate program, the first class I had to take was research, just how you do research, because there's, I mean, this is definitely the age of communication. There's just tons of material. The challenge today is knowing how to wade through all the material that's out there and find the good stuff, the nuggets, how to be a gold miner out there. But this one I definitely want to recommend and encourage everyone to read. We'll have them here for everybody. You know, first question is, what is theology? What is it? So, well, I was here to find out from you. No, I want to know what you think theology is.
Is it the study of God?
Okay, study of God.
I was going to say the study of the nature of God. But...
okay, study of the nature of God.
I was going to say the study of the facts.
Study of the facts, okay. All right.
The study of religion associated with God.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Ultimately, the study of the idea, just the theology of the theo.
Okay, okay. The word itself gives us a clue, right? Theo means what?
God.
And logos means what?
Knowledge.
Okay.
So it's usually from a Christian perspective.
Well, we're going to talk about that. We're studying from a Christian perspective, but yeah, you can go. You can be a Hindu and study theology. You could be a Muslim and study theology. There's obviously different perspectives. Okay, yeah, that's a very broad sense, but yes, it is the study of God, the nature of God, the things of God. Although it goes beyond, I mean, the classic theology that we're going to be looking at is the attributes or the nature of God, but it goes even beyond that. Why is theology so important to understand? Why? What's the big deal about theology? I mean, isn't it just good enough? We have our Bibles in quiet times. Isn't that enough? I mean, do you need any more than that?
I think because there's so many competing ideas. And that when you have a very good handle on the nature of God, a lot of times doctrines come up that contradict God's nature.
Okay.
Contradict God's nature. You can look at them and say, there's something wrong with this, and it helps you discern what is healthy and what is not healthy in your understanding of.
Okay. Okay. Key being, better saying, help us to discern what doctrines we believe or what is healthy, what is not healthy, how we practice something. Do we believe that you should do everything the Bible says?
No.
He says yes, you say no. Make your points. Why yes and why no?
There's no other, there's no other direction that we can go from but the Word. That is God.
Okay, we get all our direction from the Word, so therefore we should do whatever the Word says. Why no?
No, because God's nature has changed over time. Or God's nature hasn't changed, but what He wants us to do has changed. So we don't practice a lot of things from the Old Testament because God has
okay. Changed. We're not going to destroy all the non-Christians, right? We're not going to kill all the men and women non-Christians. That's not our goal, even though at one point in history that was a command, right? So we don't do everything. We don't even, I mean, we say on one level that we do everything the Bible says, but on another level, we know better than to do everything the Bible says, right? It does require some discernment, right? Okay, do we do everything the New Testament says? That's a classic Old Testament example. Do we do everything the New Testament tells us to do?
I would say no, because it's cultural, like men having long hair.
Okay, now you're getting into sticky issues. You know, what are cultural commands? What are temporal commands? What are, you know, universal forever commands? You know, what does the Bible teach us? How about do we do? Okay, let's just get it down to Jesus. Okay, do we do everything Jesus tells us to do? Oh, now you're getting scared.
Think about it, bro.
No, we don't.
Okay, what do we not do? What do we not believe?
When Jesus tells the rich young ruler, sell everything.
Okay.
Ask everybody to sell
everything. Okay, we don't ask everybody to sell everything, right? That's okay. That's again, we are just trying to discern. Now, when we make these discernments, okay, I'll give you another example. Jesus directed the apostles. Remember when the night before he was crucified, he washed their feet, and he told them, "You will be blessed if you do this." Right? When's the last time you washed anybody's feet?
My kid.
Huh? Yeah. I know your kids are older, so I know you haven't done that in a long time either.
What about the gouge in your eye?
Okay, yeah. All of this takes discernment, right? Of what do we apply, when do we apply it, how do we apply it? What tools are you going to use to discern? Are you going to know, is this God's will, is this not God's will? Is this what God wants? Is this not what God wants? I had a woman come up to me after church and just chew me out for having a brother do communion who had an earring on. And, you know, she quoted me Leviticus, and she was yelling at me about, you know, man shall not dress like a woman, and da da da, and, you know, and you know, she said, you only do what the Bible tells you to do. Now, I have to confess, I was a young evangelist at the time, and I had not been humbled by God enough yet, you know, and so my humble response was, well, do you do everything God tells you to do? Which is not a very good response, but, and I looked at her, and she had her skirt, of course, she didn't wear pants, but she had sneakers on. And I said, does it say anywhere in the Bible to wear sneakers? Well, no. Did Jesus wear sneakers? Well, no. Do men need to wear pants? Well, of course. Does it say anywhere in the Bible that men need to wear pants? Well, no. Did anybody wear pants in Jesus' time? Well, yeah, Germans up in Northern Europe, but certainly not anybody in Israel. Pants weren't even worn at that time. Okay, so obviously we do a lot of things that the Bible doesn't say to do. But we are given the challenge to understand how to interpret, how to apply, and one of the most, I would say the most important guideline is, what's God's will? How does God see this? You remember when Jesus was going through the fields with his disciples and everybody was criticizing him for disobeying the Sabbath? What was Jesus' response?
I'm Lord of the Sabbath.
Yeah, the Sabbath was for man, not man for the Sabbath. He gave a theological response, not a biblical response. Not just what the scripture says, that's what they were throwing at him. He was giving them back a theological response. What is God's will in this? And that absolutely will change your view on things. And it will help guide us on what we believe, what we don't believe, what we stand behind, what we don't stand, what we strictly enforce, and what we relax on. And it's dangerous waters out there trying to figure out what do we apply, what do we not apply. People who believe that you must do everything the Bible tells you to do, that's called a biblicist. Okay? It's somebody who stands by and says everything. Now the truth is, nobody's a true biblicist, because none of us can even do what everything the Bible says to do. The truth is, all of us have to figure out, okay, what do I need to do out of this, out of what's being taught here? And that is dangerous waters. And then you see why there's so many different denominations and so many different viewpoints on so many different things. And so, you know, I would say there's several just reasons. I'm going to go through them rather quickly, and then I'm going to hand it back over to John. One, why do we need to understand theology? One, because you're already a theologian. Because the fact is, everybody has to form convictions, opinions, thoughts about God and about how they respond to God or our religion. So you already are. So you might as well know something about it if you're going to do it. And everybody is doing it. Number two, your love for the Lord is greatly affected by your theology.
Yes.
It frightens me when I hear people say things like, well, I guess this ended up that way because that's what God wanted. There are many things happening in this world that are not what God wants. And to say that that's what God wants is a very dangerous thing. There are very few things that we can emphatically say, this is the will of the Lord. There aren't many things. Number three, Your theology will determine how you live. What you emphasize, what you practice, what you don't practice, it will absolutely affect how you live your life. Four, it will affect your attitude about things. How you see God. Is He really righteous? Which is the same word as fair. You know, fairness is an intrinsic part of our character, of our being. I mean, kids from very small cry out, "That's not fair!" You know, yeah. It's part of how God designed us. It was one of the arguments that C.S. Lewis presented about the existence of God. That it's innate in us. We have this sense of fairness. Another way of calling it is righteousness. Of what's right, what's fair. Okay, and if you do not see God as fair, you won't make it as a Christian. You'll eventually fall away, and I've seen that happen. Where something happens, somebody goes through a tragedy, and they get angry, they get bitter, and they leave God. And I don't mean just the church, I mean they leave God, and they're angry. Because they don't understand God. They don't understand Him. Your level of humility depends on it. And you know, humility is key to salvation, right? we don't get to heaven being prideful. And I believe the fact is, a proper understanding of God is very humbling. And this is the challenge with theology, because knowledge does what?
Puffs up.
And so you have to always be on your guard of that. Even as some of you guys I know, you love learning. I mean, I love learning. I love studying. I love digging in there and learning new things. But I have to always watch out that I don't let the things that I'm learning puff me up or make me arrogant. The truth is, a proper learning humbles you deeper. Makes you more and more humble. The more you understand the greatness of God, the more you understand how not great we are, the more humbling it is. Your thinking will become less individualistic. Number six. Your thinking will become less individualistic. Why? Because you get the big picture. Makes a big difference to get the big picture. That's exactly what Jesus was doing when He talked about the Sabbath. He was drawing back to the big picture of what God did with all this. What is really important? You know, I'll give you a classic example that we probably all painfully understand is somebody would miss midweek 5 years ago, so somebody calls them up and chews them out for missing midweek. But what you didn't know was that their parent died, or they were very sick, or something happened. And that was missing the point. That was focusing on a detail instead of understanding the big picture. What did that person really need? They needed love. They needed God is what they really need. And you are the vassal of that. They didn't need to be chewed out for something, for some detail. Which is exactly where we tend to go. Most of us, in my experience, tend to see God as very loving or very righteous. We tend towards one of those. The ones that see God very righteous, we tend towards legalism. The rules, got to follow the rules, got to stay in the lines. Those of us who tend to see God more as love, we tend to see the big picture, God just loves everybody, but we tend to mess up on where He does draw lines, and where He does say, you will not do this, or you will do this. Number seven, your discernment will be sharpened greatly. You understand what is really important, what is not so important. Number eight, your view of the Bible will be changed. It will be changed with a good understanding, with a good theology. Like I said, everybody has a theology. But a healthy, mature theology definitely changes your view of the Bible. In a good way, in a very positive way. Number nine, your defense of the faith depends on it. As we live, and John's going to launch into this in detail, we live in a world that's radically changing and becoming less and less quote-unquote Christian, and I mean that in the broadest sense. And we will have to defend our faith much more. We're going to have to make very different arguments than we used to. We used to argue about baptism. Nobody will care about baptism anymore. It's going to be about, is it Jesus? Is it Muhammad? Is it Buddha? Or is it me? You know, I mean, that's the argument's going to be much more along those lines. And lastly, is I think that we have to escape our own history in theology. You know, whether we like to admit it or not, all of us have a pair of glasses on. Some are rose-colored, some are dark-colored, some are gray-colored, depending on where you came from. A lot of us came from Catholic background, we had a certain view of God. Some of us came from evangelical backgrounds. We had a certain view of God. We all come through the Church of Christ, and more specifically, we all come through the International Churches of Christ, which absolutely is a certain view. And we have to escape that. In fact, theology in general has always been held under suspicion by Churches of Christ. I mean, the Church of Christ is traditionally very hostile to academic pursuits. Because, and let me say this, to be fair, for good reasons, because when the Church of Christ exploded and was growing and spreading across the nation, you know, there was a lot of academic people that were living in their ivory towers, writing about deeper things of God, doing nothing for people, making no difference in the world. So the Church of Christ reacts to that. But like many reactions, throws the baby out with the bathwater, you know, and just becomes very hostile towards any kind of academic pursuits. And so we have to know that. That maybe that, I'm not speaking to the audience here that's necessarily hostile, but you have to know that's our culture. That we're suspicious. And for some good reasons, because there are still a lot of, you know, a lot of these great theologians, they live in ivory towers and universities and they never leave the campus and they have no idea what the real world is like. But the fact is, we need theology. We need help. And it will help us from going to any of those extremes. Towards legalism or extreme liberalism. It helps us to keep a healthy balance. So many times you see Jesus always fighting off unhealthy extremes. Whether it's extreme legalism or throwing everything out. You know, Jesus would call things back. You see that in the Bible. You see that Paul doing that over and over and over. And we'll get into that. But theology, I love it. I think it's incredible. I think you're going to learn a lot of great things. And I think it's going to help us all. So I'll hand it over.
Great. We have a handout. Is that my thing?
Or is that yours? That's yours.
Cool. Keep the tape going here. Could somebody help with the handout? Okay, you've got a handout. This is not the notes for the class, it's just the notes for today and probably the first part of what I'm going to be doing 2 weeks from today, just to give you a feeling. And so today's class, I'm going to go off on what Robert already described, which is that we need to understand that the world is changing, the world around us is changing, and the kinds of knowledge, the kinds of understanding, the kinds of ways we need to communicate to the people around us is radically changing, and I think the study of theology is going to be helpful. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at other theologies. Somebody's asking, is there other kinds of theology? Absolutely. So and really, to some extent, it helps not only to know what God is like, but also to know what He's not like. And because a lot of times our theology includes some of these other kinds of theology and we're not aware of it. Okay, we grew up in a world where New Age thinking is affecting a lot of things. Postmodernism is affecting a lot of things. So even being aware of the competitor, which is what we're going to do here, we're going to look at the competitor, and understanding what you're not can sometimes help you understand what you are. So this is probably not the most important class of the series, to be honest with you. It's really somewhat introductory. So anyway, if you look at the outline, you can see a couple of books that are being recommended here. The first one is The Universe Next Door by James Siren. That's a book not on theology, but on worldview. So that book is relevant to today's class. I've read that. It's actually quite readable, very practical. It's the best I've seen on worldview. And then Paul Copan, which is a little bit more on the whole idea of worldview, especially on postmodernism. True for you, but not for me. And then in this course, we're trying to recommend two books. Okay, one, the little thin one that I bet you can get for less than $5. By the way, eBay is another good source, by the way. But we're going to recommend another book, but we haven't decided yet. We're getting some feedback from Bob Kirka. A lot of you saw him a couple weeks ago. So you can see the book by N.T. Wright. I know Bob Kirka recommends that. And the one by Alistair Gratt. What we're trying to do is we're trying to give you a fairly comprehensive book at the right level.
and readable. That's a pretty tough set of requirements. So anyway, so we're going to, maybe I'll send it out as an email. Anyway, so just some background here. Up to a point, we can understand Christian theology by studying comparative theology, thinking about what God is not. And bear in mind, up until the 1960s, and of course, most of you weren't around the 1960s. Jeff, you were in the late 60s, maybe. Barely, okay.
Barely.
All right. But up until the 1960s in the U.S., you could walk up to somebody on the street, and you could assume the person you're talking to was a theist. In other words, they believed that God is active, God answers prayers, there's one God. They believed in authority. They believed there is an authority that we are all subject to. Now, that might have been only 95% of people. And here it is 45, 50 years later, and maybe half would say that that's what they believe, but maybe only 20 or 30% that's actually what they believe. And because even Christianity, in quotes, has been so affected by these other kinds of theologies. And so a lot of people have a worldview based on postmodernism, naturalism, pantheism, and all these things, all these big long isms. And so we're going to describe some of those and define them. So today when you share with somebody, you don't really know. Are they coming from a pantheistic idea? Eastern religion has had a huge influence. Huge influence in America. And yes, it's had a big influence on, in quotes, Christian thinking. So it'd probably be a good idea to understand Eastern religion and where that's coming from. A lot of times you can listen to a Hindu person and it sounds really good. And one of the reasons for that is they're partly right. And it's a little confusing, you know, but they're partly right. You know, a lot of stuff they have to say about God is actually true. And so that's one of the reasons to study theology, so you can sort of start to get the ability to distinguish that. And another thing that makes it even more confusing is a lot of these people have this thinking. What they do is they kind of hijack aspects of Christian theology. So even your atheist sort of kind of believes in a personal God, but because if there is a God, it has to be a personal God. It's kind of like that. And you know, one argument people say, if that's what God's like, I'm not going to believe in Him. Right? People, you've heard that, right? See, what they're doing is they're assuming the God should be a good God that loves. Well, where did that idea come from? Where did that assumption come from? So that's why it can be so confusing. A lot of people who reject Christian theology actually believe a lot of Christian theology. Right? And a lot of people who are supposedly Christians have an admixture of all these other kinds of theology. And so that's why I think it's very good for us to be sensitive to this. And I'm adding other reasons on top of the ones that Robert already gave, which are probably even the most important reasons of all to know theology, is so that we'll just know God better. The idea that God is personal, the idea that life has a purpose, I think that's an inherent understanding. That people, even if they were not exposed to Christianity at all, would probably have that. Just like the idea of justice, that's kind of inherent to us. The idea that God is essentially good, the idea there's a moral good and evil, the idea that justice will prevail, all these things are kind of, even your atheist believes that. Atheists say, religion is evil. Well, I thought you don't believe in evil. If you're an atheist, you don't believe in evil. Well, I don't believe in evil, but I know religion is evil, so there's that inconsistency. So a lot of the things that people believe aren't supported by the worldview even they think that they hold to. So a few of the questions we're going to think about. Theological questions. What is the nature of God? What is the nature of creation? What is the nature of our relationship with God? Robert's going to be spending a lot of time talking about the nature of our relationship with God. We'll spend a little bit of time on the nature of the universe itself. And then a harder question is, where does Jesus fit in this? We're going to look at one of the theological sermons, if you will, of Paul. And it's interesting. He mentioned Jesus sort of towards the end of that lecture. We'll talk about that. Jan was talking to me yesterday. So is this class about Jesus? Well, this class is about God. And, you know, we won't probably actually be talking about Jesus specifically as much in this class as you used to. Because if you're talking about God, who are you talking about?
Jesus.
In fact, when we look at the history of Christian theology, we're going to talk about arguments over Jesus, but they really were arguments over God. So anyway, what we're going to do then is we're going to do a very, very quick survey. A very, very quick survey. Looking at some of the world religions. Before we do that, I want to do one little thing, though. Let's just think briefly. What are some of the attributes of God? I want to write them down so we'll kind of remember them. What are some of the attributes of God that we understand because we're Christians?
Creative.
Okay, creative.
Eternal.
Okay. Okay, love.
Merciful.
Okay, merciful. I'll do comma.
Patient.
Merciful. Patient. Now, I suppose you could probably just go through 1 Corinthians 13 there, but don't do that. That's not fair. That's not fair. You know. Yeah. Let's kind of get some of those bigger ones. Just, okay? So, justice.
Omni.
Yeah, so I'll do omni. What I mean is, he's all powerful, all this, all that. So he's all these all things, okay? So those are those attributes, those cool attributes about him being all powerful, all knowing, omnipresent, all those kind of things. Some other aspects of God. Okay, those are all kind of under this love, merciful. Yeah.
I am disciplinarian.
All right, justice. That's under justice. We're trying to get the big words. The big words, okay.
Passionate.
And those.
Passionate.
Passionate. Okay. Good. Yeah.
Immutable.
All right. Unchangeable. One thing that's coming out from this is these are good answers, but you know we're used to thinking of the smaller traits, maybe not the bigger traits. And that's what this class is about. Is sort of like the big traits that create the smaller traits. Now, merciful, that maybe you don't think that is a small trait, all right? But that does fall under the love. In fact, I think this is a pretty good list right here. Pretty good list.
Unfathomable.
There you go. Unfathomable. All right. Is that? I think that might fall under omni something. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. He's under understandable. So let's not have this class. All right. So anyway, just a cool little slide. One point of view is the Christian perspective is there's only one truth about God. Okay. And so Jesus says, wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. Many enter through it, but small is the great gate and narrow is the road that leads to life and only a few find it. I like that sign. I don't know where that sign came from, but it's narrowing from both lanes there. Jesus says, no one comes to the Father except through me. It seems kind of a narrow statement. But we live in a world, the postmodern world, that says all truth is truth, and it's true for you, but it's not true for me, but it's still true, and truth is determined by culture, truth is determined by society. And so, there's many different ways to God, and God as you perceive it, or God who, you know, you got your 12-step plan, and if you think of the shoebox as God, you talk to the shoebox, if that helps you to know God, and all that kind of stuff. So, we got mysticism, Islam, Baha'i, Buddhism, Confucianism, we could call it Confusionism, all these different ways to God. And there's this idea that it's all just the same. The fact is, it is absolutely not all the same. In fact, that's a ridiculous thing to say. It makes absolutely no sense. To say that Hinduism and Christianity are two different paths of the same thing, that's ridiculous. It doesn't even make sense. And we'll talk about why. So, theology, ideas about God, and then worldview. So we're going to look at some ideas about God. These are some definitions. I'll post this at the website. You just get a feeling. And some people say, from the handout on page 2, some people argue that if you really want to simplify it, and I think it's worth trying to simplify it, and you can see in the handout, it mentions three basic views of the world, three basic theologies, and you can somewhat put things under these categories. All right. So the basic three are theism, which is the idea of a single personal God, an active single personal God. That's theism. Okay. And then there's pantheism, and the pantheist says everything is one. So there is that God is the universe and the universe is God. That's the basic description of most Eastern religion. And it's the description of New Age realism. So guess who's God in that case? You're God. I'm God. We're all God. To say that you're God, we're God, we're all God is the same as Christian theism. You can see that that's insane. And the fact that New Age thinking has entered into Christianity, that should be quite disturbing. So pantheism, and you know, to shove animism and polytheism under pantheism might be a bit of a stretch. And then there's naturalism, which is the idea that that God is an irrelevant idea, and that the physical reality is really the only reality. And that's the kind of ism that I tend to come across a lot of my work. So animism, generally when they talk about African religions, they say they're animism. The animist sees gods in everything. There's the god of the tree, the god of the brooks, the god of the water, the god of the sky. And it's so everything has God in it. It's not that different from pantheism. Except pantheism doesn't think of these individual little gods and spirits and other trees and the brooks and all that. But in the end, they amount to kind of the same thing. Of course, polytheism, I don't think I need to spend a lot of time defining polytheism. Pantheism, pan means all, a belief that a spirit fills the universe. God is the universe and we are God. A dualism. You might have noticed, if you're in Mission Vision, Dr. Kirka mentioned dualism, and he said a lot of supposed Christians are dualists. A dualist sees, yin and yang and all that sort of stuff. And so the dualist sees there's good and there's evil, and there's the world is a competition between good and evil. And no particular one is necessarily going to ever win out. It's the constant competition between good and evil. And we'll see Greek philosophy tended towards dualism. And then naturalism, that the belief that the physical reality is the only one. If you're a naturalist, you don't believe in the supernatural. You don't believe in anything spiritual. No evil, no good. And you certainly don't believe in justice, because justice is a meaningless word if you're a naturalist. And then there's postmodernism, which really isn't necessarily a theology. Postmodernism is really a philosophy, but I'm telling you, postmodernism has infiltrated everything. Many, many Christian, in quotes, philosophers are postmodern in their thinking. And you can detect it. You have to get a certain... be able to smell that postmodernism. It comes in. Another way of describing postmodernism is relativism, which is, there's all different kinds of truth. There's no absolute standard of truth. It's all just a story. And some, in certain situations, one story might be better to describe that situation. So that's the truth in that. No particular truth. It's all just sort of cultural, if you will. And then, of course, there's biblical theology. I'm just going to throw it up there because that's really not our subject. We're talking about the other theologies. But just to, just to kind of give you a little grounding there. So biblical theology. In fact, really, if you just had Genesis 1 through 4, that's practically all you need. I'm serious. I mean, Genesis 1 through 4, I think, is the most profound theological treatise ever written. I mean, it establishes everything. In fact, by the time you get to the end of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, you've disproved animism, pantheism, naturalism, polytheism, humanism, just about every other ism. Seriously, Genesis 1:1, and you've got to the end of all the other isms. Because in Genesis 1:1, we see God created the heavens. So therefore, so much for pantheism. Right? God created the heavens, so obviously God is not the heavens. And God saw all that He made and was good. So much for dualism. See that? And Adam and Eve were given everything, and they were given a choice. So therefore, determinism. And of course, Christian theology says the problem is that we rebelled, right? The problem is not God. The world is good. Everything in the world is good. Every single thing in the world is good. What's the only problem? Well, you just read Genesis 3. Read Genesis 2, read Genesis 3. The only problem is us. The problem is not God. The problem is us. And that's theology. And that's Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. And then Genesis 3, God provides the solution, right? And, you know, he will strike his heel and he'll step on you and all that kind of stuff. God said to Satan, I will strike your head. That's a prophecy of the fact that God will defeat Satan through his son, Jesus. Okay, so the Christian worldview, the world is real. There exists a parallel, unseen spiritual reality. The creator of both is God, the God who reveals himself in the Bible. Human beings have both a physical and a spiritual nature, despite the appearances different to that. Although the physical world is good, evil exists. There's a definite right and wrong. Another thing is another thing that I like about Christian theology, other than the fact that it's true, that's really good, is that it answers the questions that people ask. And if you sat down and thought, what are the big questions? And then you look at pantheism, naturalism, animism, all these other isms, dualism, and they don't answer any of these questions. Or if they do, they give very, very unsatisfactory answers. Questions like, how did I get here? Why am I here? Where am I going? Why are human beings able to understand the universe? How is it that we understand the universe? Why is there pain and suffering? These are the big questions. So, anyway, a very, very, very quick overview of some world religions. Hinduism. Hinduism began, if you study it, Hinduism is not a single religion, by the way. That's part of what's confusing. Hinduism is many, many religions that sort of evolve in the subcontinent of India. In fact, the word Hinduism was invented by the British. That wasn't even a word. In fact, they also invented the word India. So Hinduism basically is this mishmash of religions that sort of kind of pervade the subcontinent of India. Started out as polytheism that was inherited from the Aryans that came in from the north, and it developed into pantheism. So basic Indian philosophy is pantheistic. And so what's that mean?
God is everything.
Yeah, so I'm looking at God. So if you want to find God, where do you look?
Everywhere.
Inside yourself. Well, everywhere, but inside yourself. Do you see that might be a bit different from Christian theology? Now, are we God? No, but we're created in the image of God. We're created in the image of God. And Hinduism is not a single religion. And, of course, it is still polytheistic. And if you go to India, the fact that it's polytheistic will hit you absolutely in the face. There's idols everywhere. Ganesh is one of the favorites. There's these, and the sort of the local Hinduism, the part that didn't get incorporated to America, is the polytheism. Hinduism in America is typically not polytheistic. They kind of put all that stuff behind and principally bring in the pantheistic idea. Brahman, the God that fills the universe, that you dissolve into when you die. So, where am I going? I guess it gives an answer, which is you're going to disappear. Right? If that was true, I guess it wouldn't be very nice to know. Buddhism, believe it or not, Buddhism is essentially atheist or agnostic. Right? Now, most Buddhists are not atheistic or agnostic, but their founder was. He refused to answer the question of God. Despite all that, it is still pantheistic in its thinking. And so the theology of Buddhism and Hinduism is fairly similar. So it's either non-theistic or pantheistic. It's really hard to get your finger on what Buddhism is. But Buddhism basically leads to the same kind of philosophy, which is you have to sort of lose yourself. You separate yourself from other people. You become as dispassionate as possible. And you try to be unaffected by other people. See how this that the diametric opposite of Christianity? It's the diametric opposite. You know, I've been to Cambodia. I've been to Thailand. Guess who do most of the benevolent works in those countries?
The Christians.
The 1%, the 0.5%. It's not an accident. That's their theology. It's, you know, and New Agers and the Hindu and the you know, a lot, there's a lot of Hindu and Buddhist influence, a lot in America, and it looks so cool. It seems so, these people are so spiritual, but they're also so self-focused. All right, and into themselves, they don't look selfish. They don't. But if you look at their philosophy, it is. Anyway, I'm not going to spend time on New Age. We could spend a lot. New Age is essentially sort of a Western version of Buddhism / Hinduism / occult / Gnosticism. So all those Eastern isms all kind of combined together. It's sort of choose your own. It's kind of like the cafeteria style Eastern religion. That's the New Age thing. And the New Age thinking, especially in California, folks, unfortunately. Yeah, a question?
Yes, about Hinduism.
Yeah.
When I think about Hinduism, I think about, of course, India, but I think about, okay, in this region of India, they worship a certain god, and in this region of India, in this city, they've got this
right.
God. I'm wondering, because Hinduism is this idea that gods are everywhere, do they have problems in India with one town fighting with another town about whether their god exists, or they just accept them?
No, because I don't... Not that I know of. It's not like in the Middle East where they would fight over these different gods. Yeah, because I don't think... I don't completely understand why they don't take it seriously. All right, but it seems like, you know, you go to the next town and they're into Ganesh. Over here we're into Vishnu. Krishna, Shiva, and all that kind of stuff. That's their trinity, Vishnu, Krishna, and Shiva. I don't see a lot of fighting over that. Yeah, Robert, a comment?
Yeah, one of the reasons why, what we call Hinduism has evolved, there are basic beliefs. One of those is to do no harm to others, is a basic belief. And it's kind of opened the door towards all these religions coming together. So that's why you get even like a Gandhi who can call himself a Christian, call himself a Hindu, call himself
a Muslim.
Jewish, call himself a Muslim. Because that's the basic tenet of their belief,
right,
is to be all inclusive. So therefore it'd be contrary to their belief to go to war. Now obviously That's what is officially believed. Then you'd ask anybody who, because there is a lot of violence in India, but it's between Muslim and Hindus.
Right, the religious wars are between Muslims and Hindus, not amongst Hindus.
Because Muslims obviously don't have that belief in that basic tenet. So, but that's part of what united all the different religions in India under the umbrella of Hindu, was that core
right.
belief.
Good. Other questions?
I don't know, but there is Christian persecution from India, even from our church, I think, over there, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I was in India, they made it very clear, don't say anything, even possibly that can be interpreted negative, about Hinduism while you're in India. Don't do that. Which I didn't plan on doing anyway. But as long as you don't criticize Hinduism publicly, you're okay, but down on the personal level, because you're accepting a totally, totally different theology. And they're very well aware that Christians reject the caste system in the whole cultural setting. And so because of the history there, they're very well aware of that. If you become a Christian, you're rejecting their entire worldview. And so there's going to be a strong negative reaction. I could tell you stories about one sister. When I was there, she told me the story. When she became a Christian, her father basically beat her up, and he got the brothers that had studied with her, got them thrown in jail. They spent a good time. I met one of the guys who was thrown in jail over this. She could not come to church for something like 6 or 7 years. He just basically locked her up, refused to let her out of the house. And finally she did go, and now she's married to a Christian. She works for the church, but it's pretty tough, yeah. Yeah.
And one thing, even looking at any of these religions, is to always remember there's the official religion, and then there's the practical religion.
Right.
I mean, night and day different. You know, they would say the same thing to us. Well, Christianity teaches love. You know, why do you Christians do all these wars and wipe out all these people? It can be very different what is the official belief and what is the practical belief.
Right, so you can run into Hinduism in America, and the person may not be aware that they're Hindu because they're affected, by, influenced by New Age. New Age is really cool, because how would you like to be told that you're God and there's no such thing as sin? Wouldn't that be cool? Because the Hindus, don't think of karma as the same thing as sin. It's not the same thing as sin. It sounds similar, but it's definitely not. And so, New Age, you're God, I'm God, we're all God. It's Western pantheism. It's a syncretistic blend of Gnosticism, Hinduism, spiritualism, mysticism, Buddhism, paganism. It's monism, that's another fancy word, which says there's only one reality. Okay, and here's a nice quote from a famous New Ager guy. Once we begin to see that we're all God, then I think the whole purpose of life is to re-own the God likeness within us. That'll solve the problems of the world, won't it? Okay, good. I'll skip this. That's fine. The idea that there is no sin, I think that's worth noticing. It's a very experientially oriented sort of religion, that's for sure. It's very appealing. Islamic theology. Okay, I think that we should be aware of Islamic theology. Now, of course, Islamic theology is more similar to Christian theology. Because they're theists. They're theists. Okay, whereas your Shinto, Jaina, Baha'i, all these are non-theists. They're pantheistic. So this is our first look at a theistic religion. So like Christianity, Judaism, it's monotheistic. But there are several differences. And these are key differences that we're going to be focusing in on a different aspect of God. In Islam, God is more like the Neoplatonic idea of God. I'm going to give you a very one-minute version of explaining Plato's philosophy. That had a huge influence in the world of the Bible. So therefore, we're going to talk about that just because it gives you perspective to what Paul said. A lot of what Paul's saying is speaking out against this Platonic idea that God is very, very distant. Acts 17 is a wonderful discussion where Paul is defeating this Greek idea of God being distant. But if you read the Quran, and I've read the Quran, if you want to talk about it, it's always nice to actually read it, you know. I have a friend who says, I want to teach a class on Islam. I'm really excited. I want to teach a class on Islam. I said, well, have you read the Quran yet? No. I said, well, don't talk to me about doing a class on Islam if you haven't read the Quran. Oh, okay. So anyway, if you read the Quran, God is very, very distant. Sounds so similar to this Greek concept of God, and I'll talk about that a bit more. Also, there's work salvation, obviously, and so basically, the Muslim has really no idea if they're going to go to heaven. There's no such thing as salvation. So you try to become more and more righteous. All right, so it's not a matter of God saving us; it's a matter of us saving ourselves by the Bible, the Quran describes God as merciful and as righteous. By the way, so God's mercy is there and God's righteousness is not there, but is there. But what's not there is salvation. All right, so God reaching down, offering us, and now reacting to that. Okay, salvation by your own effort. If you can look up those surahs, Surah 40, verse 9, etc. This will all be at the website. You earn your grace, you earn favor of Allah, you earn salvation, you earn paradise. So in Islam, salvation is earned through the efforts of those who are pre-selected by Allah. That there's predestination. And there's a radical predestination. You'll hear Muslims say all the time, Inshallah. Which means God's will. Right? And, by the way, predestination is a biblical topic, and we'll talk about that later on in the class. But, you know, basically, whether or not you go to heaven is chosen not by you, but it's chosen by God. Alright, so who reaches out to whom? That's one thing that separates Christian theology from every other ology, if you will. Okay, so who reaches out to who? In all other religions, either there is no God, in which case, oh well, just you die, you're dead like Rover, dead all over, or you're trying to reach up to God, but in Christianity, God reaches down to us. So here's a list of the religions where you try to save yourself versus the religions where God's reaching down to us. All right, a little bit on worldview. The Hindu worldview is this: the world is an illusion. Okay, the Eastern idea is this world is an illusion. That's the Greek idea as well. The Greek idea is that this world is, it's not that it's an illusion, but that it's like, it's not the ultimate reality. This world is decaying, it's gross, it's ugly, it was a mistake. That's the Greek idea. That's the theological setting in which the New Testament was written, is that the world is a mistake. It's bad. It's evil. All right, but in the Hindu worldview, then, is the world is an illusion. The reality is Atman. The reality is this universal soul into which our goal is to dissolve into that soul. Like, so, you know, salt and water, you know, that they would use that analogy.
Basically become nothing, right?
Become nothing. And Buddhism is sort of similar. Basically, the Eightfold Path is a path towards, by being totally selfish, losing yourself, essentially. By drawing back, by being unaffected. Because if you're affected by this world, because this world is evil. This world is evil. It's an illusion. So if you're affected by this world, then you can't escape this world. All right, so that's the theology, that's the worldview. And you've got the Eightfold Path. Suffering is getting what you don't want. The cause of suffering is desire, which leads to rebirth. The way to end suffering is to end desire. The way to end desire and suffering is the Eightfold Path. So Buddhism encourages not compassion, which is the Christian response to suffering, but dispassion. Okay? That's the worldview. Again, Islamic worldview is God is distant. I'm not going to spend time on the biblical worldview because I want to get to Paul's response to various theologies here. Okay? There's some stuff about the one thing that separates the Christian theology from other theologies is that there's evidence behind it. I mean, basically, the evidence behind these other theologies is you agree with it. Alright, that's not a very strong evidence, okay? Maybe you could argue there's evidence behind naturalism, but these other ideas don't really have the kind of evidence that we have. Alright, naturalism, the belief that the only reliable... So, yeah?
I have to go to my grandmother's funeral to get already, so I'm sorry I got to leave early, guys. I'll see you all next week.
Okay. Great.
Be safe.
All right, two more things, and then I'm going to kind of shift back towards the Bible. Two more worldview/theologies. And the next one is naturalism. We haven't talked about that yet. So what's the naturalist say? The naturalist says the only reliable way to know what's true is the scientific method. Okay? So if that's true, there's no basis for ethics, morality, supernatural, there's no God, there's no truth. That's what it has in common with postmodernism. There's no truth other than physical truth, but no truth about the big things. No answers to the question why. Why is the universe here? Why am I here? Just random stuff bumping and molecules bumping each other and you're here.
But you don't even have the right to ask the question.
Right, because who am I anyway? I'm just chemicals moving around in a brain, a sack of chemicals moving around in the brain. So when I say I want to go there, it's not I that want to go there, it's the chemicals in my brain that want to go there. Because I don't exist. Right? That's not very satisfying, but if it's true, the natural response to that is, well, buck up, guy, you just accept the truth, which is you don't exist. I mean, the stuff exists, but... consciousness is not real. Consciousness is just our thinking, our description of this stuff. Not a very happy philosophy. If it's true, then there's no basics for ethics or morality. So why is it evil to kill? Well, under naturalism, basically, if there's any purpose at all under naturalism, it's for you to reproduce your chromosomes. That's the only purpose, if there's any at all. And so if in order to produce more copies of your chromosomes, you have to kill somebody. In fact, if you kill somebody who doesn't have as good chromosomes, as good genes, that might actually be a good thing. I mean, that's what they do in nature, right? They just kill each other. And in fact, killing is good in nature in some ways. You know, the lion improves the herd. It's better than, you know, and to some extent that's even actually true. So there's no basis for morality, no basis for... So all I say is if naturalism is right, then that's kind of a bummer. It's kind of a bummer. No justice. The idea of justice, figment of your imagination. And you know, human rights, where did the idea of human rights come from? I'll tell you where it came from. It came from Christianity. And so most of these naturalists are really, really big on human rights. And what they forget is that according to their system, there are no rights. Unless we just decide to say that there are. So that's naturalism. The only that which can be observed and measured through the technique of the scientific method is real. So here's a great statement of naturalism, this wonderful philosophy it's a dominant philosophy in intellectual circles. It says, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if they're at the bottom, and here's his theology. No design, no purpose, no evil, no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. All right, that's one of the theologies. That's naturalism, which leads to nihilism, if you're honest about it. Nietzsche was probably the most honest naturalist there ever was, and if you know much about Nietzsche. And then there's postmodernism. That's our last little category. Like I said, postmodernism is not a theology. Postmodernism is the idea that there is no ism. It's just all whatever. There's no truth. So, in fact, postmodernism celebrates diversity. And, you know, I do too. I kind of like to celebrate cultural diversity. There's good things about postmodernism, by the way. Postmodernism kind of is a reaction against Western scientific materialism, which may be a good thing. But the problem is, it leaves us with, instead of naturalism, it leaves us with nothing in particular, which is not so good. So basically, postmodernism, which influences everything at the universities, and it really, think about what you hear at school, right? You can't put anybody down. You can't go around saying it's wrong to do that because that's really judgmental. This whole idea that you can't be judgmental, that's postmodernism's influence. You could argue this is the dominant thinking of our age, postmodernism. But interesting, it's funny because it's based on not belief in anything. In fact, the only thing postmodernists are sure about is that postmodernism is true. That's the only thing they're sure about. That's supposed to be a joke. That's one of those things. Okay. Truth, it's true for you, not true for me. Self is a construction of our society. No way to discover what's the best worldview. All right. Now, let's go to Acts 17. Let's go to Acts 17. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show Paul addressing some of these worldviews, some of these theologies. Acts 17. So we're on page 3 of our outline, if you're following along with that. So here we see Christian theology confronting the theology that's relevant to the Greek world. And what we're talking about is Gnosticism, Epicureanism, Stoicism, and of course, polytheism, as well as Platonism, and soon to be Neoplatonism. I love what Paul does here. No, by the way, if you look at Acts 17, the reason I think this is a good model is because Paul changed his sermon when he was dealing with people who didn't understand theism. When he was speaking to Jews, they understood authority. They understood right and wrong. They understood justice. They understood the idea that we're going to die and that we're going to be accountable. So he could jump right into the resurrection, the miracles, the fulfillment of prophecy. Right? But like Robert pointed out, the world is changing fast. And the way we explain God to the world, I think the model here might be very, very helpful. Because the world that we're living in now is becoming more and more like this world. This world where, you know, there's all kinds of religions, all kinds of competing worldviews. So let's look at Acts 17. Starting in verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was troubled within him when he saw the city was full of idols. So one thing we see is idolatry. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with those who worship God, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Then also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers argued with him. Some said, "Who is this pseudo-intellectual? What is he trying to say?" So here you see Paul reasoning with them. Okay, so he's using a logical argument. What he's trying to do is he's trying to make them understand the real implications of their worldview. I think that's one of the things that theology can help you to do. Is if you understand Christian theology, you understand the implication of that, then we can make people aware of that. And what we can do is we can make them see the implications of what they believe. That's what Paul's doing. In this little sermon, he's making them aware of what they really actually believe. And if that's true, what becomes true? And he's comparing that to the vision of God. The vision of the world that according to Christian theology. Yeah.
I was going
to
say, my translation, which I don't have any idea, it says, what is this ignorant show-off trying to say?
This ignorant what?
Show-off.
Show-off, yeah. They didn't respect him at all. But they're going to find out that that was a mistake. Because it turns out Paul knows what he's talking about. He's smart. In fact, what he's going to do is he's going to quote the Roman philosophers. They're going to that shut him up. And I think it's good for us to understand these other theologies, because when people start talking, we can tell them first of all what they believe, and then we can tell them the implications. So I think it's very helpful. Anyway, so he found common ground with them, by the way. Let me see. Others replied. Let's skip down. They took him and brought him to the Areopagus. First of all, he reasoned first in the synagogue. And there, I'm sure he shared about the fulfilled prophecies. He shared about the fact that the Old Testament is about Jesus. He talked about the miracles of Jesus. But in Paul's treatise here, he doesn't even talk about that stuff. He's talking about theology. He's confronting them with theology, not even with Jesus. And I'm not saying we don't confront people with Jesus, but I'm saying that people may not even be ready to understand Jesus.
Sure.
You know, to most people, he's just a guy who has a nice moral system. And it's because they don't understand theology. They don't understand authority. So anyway, verse 22. Then Paul stood in the middle of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I can see you are extremely religious in every respect." So he's there. You know, we got some common ground here. You know, and I think finding common ground of theology is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. So you don't start out by attacking them. You start out by I notice that you believe that this world is created. Or I notice that you believe that there is more than just the physical reality. Finding a common ground. He did that. "For as I was passing through and observing the objects of your worship, I even found an altar on which was inscribed to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and everything in it." See, God made the world. And right here, what he's doing is he's speaking against Stoicism. See, Stoicism was essentially pantheist. The Stoics believed, kind of like, you know, Star Wars, the Force, you know, which is essentially, Star Wars is essentially Buddhist. And The Matrix. The Matrix is basically Buddhist philosophy put into a nice little movie. They were pantheists, or the really, really, really fancy word is panentheists. Because the pantheists believe God is everything, and the Stoics believe God is in everything. Alright? And see, Paul's saying, no. See, God created the world. So God exists completely apart from the world. And that's that omnipresent, omnipotent, that's all those omni things. He's revealing them with theology. "Neither is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives everything life and breath and all things. From one man He's made every nation of men to live over the earth. He's determined their appointed times, the boundaries of where they live, so they might see God, perhaps reach out to Him and find Him. Alright, so now we've gotten rid of the Epicurean idea, because the Epicurean idea is God, it's deism. Did I define deism? Did I forget to define deism? Alright, I've got about 7 minutes to go. I'm good here. Deism is the idea that God is creator. So the deist says there is one God. That God created the universe, and that God's over here doing something else and kind of leading the world to itself. That's a very common idea. Albert Einstein was a deist. George Washington was a deist. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. Benjamin Franklin was a deist. Isaac Newton was a deist. Very common belief. A lot of scientists are deists because they can't miss creation. It's obvious. They can't miss creation. But the Epicurean says God is very distant. Sounds a bit like the Muslim idea of God. God is very, very distant. In fact, I believe that Muhammad's idea of God came a lot from Greek philosophy. It helped you to understand Islam, is to understand the connection between Islam, believe it or not, yes, and Greek philosophy, Greek's ideas about God. So the Epicurean says God is very, very, very distant. And Paul says God is involved in your life individually. So he said he made every nation. He's determined where they're going to live. And basically what he's saying is God wants to reach out to us. And all he's asking is that we reach out to him. There's theology. And he's radically trying to turn around their world. Now, is the whole crowd going to say, thank you for telling me the truth? Is that what happened? No, but he totally, totally challenged their thinking on theology. I think that's what we need to do. We need to understand theology, and we need to confront people with the reality of true theology and their mistakes. He's not far from each one of us. He's close by. So far, he's basically disproved Epicureanism. Epicureanism being the idea that the God creator is very distant. The Epicurean is kind of like the existentialist. Basically, the existentialist says, God is not involved at all. There's two kinds of existentialism. There's theistic existentialism, which says, God exists, but he's not really involved. So you got to carve out your own niche. And that's what the Epicurean said is, you got to carve out your own niche, kind of create your own reality. Half the Epicureans were totally worldly. They'd, eat, drink, be merry, and have sex, and for tomorrow you die. The other half were totally ascetics and said we're going to totally, deny ourselves everything. Very, they were kind of schizophrenic there. Anyway, for in him we live and move and have our being. And there's some more theology. Because God lives outside of everything, and yet he fills the universe at the same time. That's theology. And we are God's offspring. And now he's going to go against some of the other, he's already gone against polytheism. And also the Platonic idea that there's a separate reality and that this world is bad. Because he says he created this reality. It says that we're God's offspring. We shouldn't think the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image. So there's polytheism. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God now commands all people everywhere to repent. Who has he not mentioned yet?
Jesus.
That's interesting. Because until they understand the nature of God, Jesus is going to make no sense. I'm telling you, Jesus doesn't make sense to a lot of people around us. They've made their own Jesus. Hindus believe in Jesus. Just talk to them. But they don't understand Jesus. Muslims believe in Jesus, by the way. In fact, I think everybody believes in Jesus except the atheists. Everybody believes in Jesus. But they don't understand God. And so you have to work on theology there. Because I don't think we can correct our understanding about Jesus until we correct our understanding about God. Yeah.
You said believe in Jesus and believe that he existed.
That he existed, he was a good guy, like one of the best. The Hindus make him into a nice Hindu guru.
It's like a guy.
The Muslims make him to a prophet just like Moses or Muhammad. So everybody makes Jesus into, basically they adapt Jesus to their own theology. He's a bodhisattva to the Buddhists. You know, and that, you know, that's another Buddhist thing. So, so basically it says God is creator, verse 24. And verse 28, he exists outside of creation. He's personal, and he's given us a purpose. Okay, so that Muslim theology doesn't work there. He's going to bring everything into judgment. So much for dualism. Maybe he's going to roll up the carpet, and evil is going to be judged. So much for dualism. And then he quotes from Aratus, the Stoic philosopher. He says, we are his offspring. But what he's saying is, see, Aretas, who's a Stoic, says we are his offspring, but that doesn't make sense. According to Stoicism, that we are his offspring doesn't make sense. But according to Christian theology, that we are his offspring does make sense. It does make sense. Then finally, he introduces Jesus. And he set up the theological background so that Jesus makes sense. And I'm going to finish in 2 minutes, by the way. So he says, he's going to judge the world in righteousness by the man he's appointed. He's provided proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. And then when they heard about the resurrection, see, wow, that's when they really had a problem. The resurrection, that confronted everything. Because if you could raise from the dead, then... And he's claiming this as a fact. As a fact that Jesus was raised from the dead. And if Jesus was raised from the dead, that means judgment is real. Dualism can't be right. Gnosticism can't be right. Stoicism, Epicureanism. So Jesus raised from the dead. So yeah, we're going to confront people with Jesus, but I think we need to sometimes deal with theology. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. We'll see you. Actually, I won't see you next Saturday at 9, but you'll see each other and you'll see Robert. So, thanks.
Thank you.
I'll take up, and I'll talk about Pythagoras. I'll talk about the Gnosticism. Because there, what I'm going to be doing is setting up the Paul. So to explain.